The medium is the message, money makes a dance. Love is the product, the joke is in, the joke is in, the joke is in your face.
I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Natural disasters
and eventually the end of the world. Are You Serious? Welcome once again to the Are You Serious show, a production of Mondo Globo Network. That's Mondo Globo, GLOBO.net. In her memoir, Frantic Transmissions to and from Los Angeles, Kate Braverman writes, "Art is the audacity to render deformity as well as perfection." She called it engaging the mutating subtext in Mortal Kombat. And this is a book that made me want to get up and do cartwheels when I was reading it this week. And Kate Braverman will be my guest, our guest on today's show.
You do cartwheels?
I am
part of your regimen.
I am completely incapable, actually. I'd never even thought about doing them until I'd read this book. By the way, that's a positive rather than a negative.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you never know. And before I welcome my co-hosts, I want to let you know that our website at areyouseriousradio.com now takes audio comments. So if you've got something to say about what you hear, and you'll have a microphone of some sort going into your computer, just go to the site and click on any button that says, "Send me an audio." And if you're clever or witty enough, we'll play it on a future show, and maybe we'll even respond. We'll curse you out or otherwise debate your insipid point. And we're here with our co-hosts, Jeff Deal.
Yeah.
Steve Robles.
Hello.
And Diana Brown.
Hello, are you, gentlemen? That's always great to be here. And I know that you and our listeners have been following the evolving situation with Yahoo in China and a few other American corporations. And we know that on October 14, 2005, Mr. Liu, a freelance writer and a Chinese advocate of internet freedom, publicly accused Yahoo of betraying its customers and supporting dictatorship. Yes, we're
hip to it.
We're hip to that. He has an open letter on his website that he sent to co-founder Jerry Yang for providing information on Chinese journalist Shi Tao to the Chinese Communist Party authorities. And he goes on to say, in fact, that such companies as MSN and Google are complicit with the CCP's internet suppression, but it's hard to say whether these companies have ever gone so far as to betray their customers as Yahoo has. And this is a pretty interesting situation for Google to find themselves in. As Jeff reminded us earlier this week, Google's corporate motto is to do no evil.
Don't be evil.
Don't be evil. Do no evil.
Something like that.
Close to that. We're going to
do no evil is a little bit Catholic for them.
Yeah.
I think it's
very nerd kind of don't be evil, straightforward.
Right. Yeah. Don't be evil, like don't suck.
Yeah,
like,
don't be sucky.
Don't suck. Unfortunately, it's been confirmed that Yahoo did, some might say, suck, because they did assist in the action against Mr. Xi. And they said they had no choice but to comply, which has a lot of people arguing both sides of that, that, you know, they say they had to. Is this a case of when in Rome?
So, I mean, I think we're up to three people, I believe, that they are accused of having turned in
exactly
to the authorities for expressing dissident views, basically.
Exactly. And they're saying they absolutely had to do this because they're doing business in China, and this is the rules of China. And some, you know, commentators have defended Yahoo, saying that, well, that's what they have to do. They can't defy the government. Bill Gates even came out and took a rare step of standing up for the arch rival, arguing that, you know, state censorship was no reason for technology companies not to do business in China. But
presumably they might be doing the very same thing. Although,
of course,
I mean,
they are.
Yahoo is in a unique position in terms of it being the used more for email. For
exactly.
instance. See, and this is what makes me think of IBM and during World War II, yeah. how they created
the punch card system
for the concentration camps. And I always like when I started reading up on American industrial corporate collaboration with building up Germany, building up the German war machine right up to the point where it was declared illegal.
Exactly.
And sometimes beyond that point, I always wondered, you know, why did they do that? And being very naive without really thinking too hard about it. And now when I really think about how business works and how the market works, the question is really is how could they possibly have not done so
when there was
you know, and that's the question that they face now with Yahoo and that all those guys face now.
Well, all these guys had to come up against a committee in a hearing on the 15th, I think it was, of February. And people were very, very much on board with what you're saying, are you? In fact, U.S. Rep. Tom Lantos from California, a Democrat from California, during the hearing, he said, "Your abhorrent activities in China are a disgrace."
He said it like this. "Your activities in China are a disgrace."
I think that was the governor of California.
Actually, that is one of the best imitations of the governor of California I've ever heard.
Really? It was supposed to be kind of... Lantos kind of reminds me of Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood.
he does have that quality.
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah,
he kind of reminds me of like Deputy Dog or like the really sad dog in that cartoon. But then I was raised by television, so I digress. Also, another critic went on to say that, this was U.S. Rep. Chris Smith. He said, "Playing by China's rules was tantamount to ratting out Anne Frank in Nazi Germany." But, you know, as you brought up, American corporations trading in Germany right up until it was illegal is not exactly new. I mean, Grandpa Prescott Bush's association with the...
No, that was after
Harriman Bank.
Illegal.
Exactly. Yeah. And after, you know, Roosevelt signed the Trading with the Enemy Act in October 1942.
See, my theory with Google, Google was hesitant, actually, about going public.
Yes.
Because they felt that they would lose control over this very thing that they had, the don't be evil thing. And I read a biography of Google, and they went through this whole process of deciding, okay. And I really think it's conceivable that if they weren't public, if they weren't actually in the stock market,
right.
Then an organization could make a decision not to compete in China and to simply be a smaller company. It's unlikely that they would do it, but it would at least there would at least be that possibility.
That's
but
true.
Once you're in the market, your whole company is going to collapse.
Bottom line is the bottom line.
And the market demanded that Google go into
Absolutely.
China. But I'm not sure the comparison to Germany. I mean, China's our friend.
What would happen?
Isn't China our friend?
I get really tired of everybody comparing everything to Hitler, but I think
no, I never do. I think everything in reality can be drawn to Hitler. you can a bobby pin. You can right. like you know
you get my breakfast.
But here's a hypothetical question because I don't understand how these companies, these multinational thing works. Whenever you got different company or different countries with different laws, like say that a Chinese immigrant who is now an American citizen has relatives in China. And one of these relatives is imprisoned and or killed by the Chinese government as a result of information that it got from Google or Yahoo.
Right.
Could this person who lives here now sue those companies for a wrongful death or whatever?
I would predict.
And if that was the case,
like
then
that would affect
the bottom line, and then they might think again about, you know, going in and doing business in countries where...
Exactly, but as compared to the entire market of China, I mean, they might think twice about, you know, if it happened to somebody in Nepal or some diddly squat
country. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like saying...
Market of however, what, a billion people or whatever it is.
Well, this is what's interesting, though. Mr. Liu challenges Yahoo to support the legal basis of their decision because, and this is what's interesting, apparently Yahoo's, you know, location was in Hong Kong and... It's a former British colony. Now, while it was given back to China, it's still an independent judiciary. So in the end, they may not have had to comply simply because of their location and their separate rules. So that's very interesting. That's something that is yet to be fully delineated.
Well, I think the Brits should never have given up their empire. Kate Braverman is the author of four novels, including the 1979 cult classic Lithium for Medea. and her phenomenal current book, Frantic Transmissions to and from Los Angeles. And welcome, Kate.
Hi, are you?
Good to have you here. And one of the things that comes across, obviously, is this love-hate relationship with Los Angeles. And one of the things I like about it, actually, is the love of Los Angeles, the sort of how it's an appropriate postmodern landscape. There's something about the emptiness of it all that...
It's a city that really lends itself to invention, because particularly when I was growing up, there was nothing there. It was a trailer park on sand. It was like a little sleepy Mexican fishing town rocked with an oaky beat, and was always a city of emotional apartheid. It was always a city where we had no Mexicans, we had no blacks. It was always a city that was building towards some future that did not include the people that actually lived there, the people of rumor that could be lured to the new Los Angeles.
So the extras arrived there first, basically.
Yes, they had to have an infrastructure. And in fact, later, thinking back on it, Los Angeles, even when we were doing much better financially and no longer living in the stucco slums, it was like a company town. Everyone worked for the movies at that point, or they worked in the infrastructure, whether it was doing catering, whether it was doing sewing. Somehow the sense of being a company town, I think, really is part of the DNA of the psychology of Los Angeles.
It seems like downtown Los Angeles and the rest of Los Angeles are almost like different planets.
I mean,
they're entirely different. You feel like you're... Even the sun feels different.
The downtown of Los Angeles is completely irrelevant. I mean, there's no...
In my book, I say we only went there on field trips,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's the whole place empties out after 6 p.m. It becomes a ghost town.
It does. It's
well, that's strange. Downtown, but our downtown is not that different either when everyone leaves downtown.
That's true.
Just that Los Angeles is so massive that there is no, it's not like the Mission where you know you can go and get action at night. I mean, there's certainly when I was growing up, and it's become a completely different city. I've noticed that because I just got back. So it is a totally different city in the 10 years that I've left, and it became a completely different city while I lived there.
Yeah, I've been gone there for about 10 years, and it's completely different than when I left. And the L.A. that you describe as growing up in is completely different than the L.A. that I grew up in, where it was its identity was completely infused by the minority experience.
Your identity?
The identity of the city at large.
Was infused by...
By the time I was growing up.
Area. Largely Hispanic area.
Yeah, largely Hispanic area.
Well, that's the real Los Angeles that I always like to write about, but that's not what people want to read about. And
well, actually, what you do is, I mean, you write about both, and you make these transitions where both are completely acceptable. I mean,
A while, we were living in Beverly Hills. We were one block into the Beverly Hills School District in an apartment, and... So I consider my short stories that they should really be called the Beverly Hills Noir stories, the true nightmare of women who get a nosebleed when they have to go east of La Cienega Boulevard, sort of like getting a nosebleed if you have to go past Fillmore, you know, in Pack Heights or something.
Yeah.
One of the little jokes about the town. But I think L.A. is always... not been a welcoming city to artists since the bohemian scene fell apart. I was a founding member of the Venice Poetry Workshop in 71 after I ran away to the Hate when I was 15 and no one read. I noticed that after a couple of weeks, it was sort of a little bit of a problem.
How can you see the words?
After a couple of weeks, I could see no one, there are no books here. And they said, oh, you need to go across the bridge. So I spent 8 years in Berkeley. So I actually did graduate from Berkeley High and Cal. So I have deep roots in this area, and we've been living here 5 years, and I love San Francisco. It is one of the few places in the United States I can live.
Well, let's get into these comparisons in a little while, but first I want to ask you to read a segment from the book, which I think is you go ahead and introduce.
Okay, now this is a completely experimental piece of writing, and I had no idea what it would end up in or what it would be. I published it as a short story in Zizova, and it's a posthumous, obviously, imaginary interview with Marilyn Monroe. And the reason I came up with this is having spent 7 years working on a Frida Kahlo novel, which seemed on the outside to be a perfect vehicle for me. She's a communist, a great artist, much better than her husband, a surrealist, bisexual, a morphine addict. You know, it looked like it had a lot going for me, you know, on the surface. And I don't usually work from the outside in. I work from the inside out. So okay. I found that working with Frida Kahlo was like 7 years in cement. And I still like the idea of working with traditional forms and subverting them. Like I did a series of poems called Classified Ad that are actually poems built on the classified ad format. So I went back to revisit what could be done with the Q&A. And so Marilyn Monroe, someone with whom I have absolutely no interest at all, one of the fantastic discoveries that you have, the revelation of being the kind of writer I am, is that you don't know what's going to happen because it's completely improvisational. And I started working on Marilyn Monroe and found that she was infinitely malleable for Kate Braverman, and that it was much easier for me to be exactly who I am working through Marilyn Monroe than I was ever able to do with Frida Kahlo. So this is an example of a question. Question: what do you think of Los Angeles? Answer: Los Angeles has a rancid gleam like spoiled lemons. It coats everything in a bad childhood waxy veneer flashback. Sun laminates you like photographs stuck between cellophane. People keep cemeteries and scrapbooks, little prisons they show to strangers. The images are indistinct and greasy. They could be anyone. You could buy them in a thrift store for a quarter and pretend they're your relatives. Los Angeles reminds me of children in foster homes at nightfall when they take their clothes off. Things with ropes and pieces of metal are done to them and added on garages with the freeway rushing in the background like a cheap soundtrack. It's in sync, but it has no meaning. Question: is there more to this yellow? Did it inspire you to become a platinum blonde? Answer: it's not platinum, which suggests constellations and redemption. It's another yellow entirely. It comes from rotting petals and camera flashes that permanently scar your face. It leaks from clusters of stucco that remind me of blisters and lumps you get on your lips from kissing the wrong people.
Thank you.
It's part of the interest of that that I like. When a piece works, it works on every conceivable level. Right. And as it goes through, besides the obvious gender issues, there is the issue of having an emotionally hemorrhaging person telling you exactly how it feels and being formatted and processed in the interview so that she is not heard. And the wider meaning that this has, I have found, in our daily lives is quite profound. How often we tell one another and hear from one another real revelations of a soul and a mind and don't hear it and don't respond. And so this was a corporate look at Marilyn Monroe. And having just done an interview with the LA Times, I can tell you that the interview as an artistic format is gone. and that we have now interview by Google, by collage off of websites. I've learned so much on this tour.
The interview was such a great format for so many years. So many extraordinary, if you read like old Rolling Stones even or Playboy, Arianna Fallaci, all these amazing people.
These people probably would not be published today with the incredible corporatization of media that we're all experiencing, and particularly here in San Francisco, where I keep saying there just isn't enough critical apparatus. It's like I call San Francisco a land of 10,000 votives, each with a dozen devotees, like 12 perfect roses, and it's always Valentine's Day. But having now come back from a tour of the country, I find that charming.
Well, you were saying that this book earlier, before we started the show, that this book really should be taught because it has so many
of writing tricks.
Yeah, tell us about the lesson. What I like is the way it just moves. I started reading the book and I was like, okay, so this is going to be sort of visionary and poetic, and then I'm in the middle of like a lot of Jewish jokes,
comedy.
Yeah, it goes through a lot of different.
I was going
places.
To Cobb's every night. For almost a year to listen to stand-up comedy, because I'm an improvisational experimental writer, and it's another form that draws my attention. And I love stand-up comedy, and so this was my first attempt to write stand-up comedy. And I felt that the Jewish experience in particular would lend itself very well to, and it always has. Marginalized people always use, in American culture, have always used comedy as a way of being able to express their aggression, which they couldn't do normally, or their hostility. And I would suspect, I don't have a television and I do not subscribe to any corporate media of any kind, which means I live in my own world, of course. But I would suspect now that the comedians would be gay and black in the way that they were all Jewish when I was young.
And these were poor Jews that your parents said.
We were paranoid. California on welfare.
Beautiful expressions of a particularly Jewish sort of paranoia.
Well, it was like the diaspora after the diaspora. Not enough of an exile to be on the East Coast already. we were in a play, La Cienega, La Tierra. Who can say it? It's growing. Bougainvillea. Who can pronounce it? You have a problem, you call the manager, the apartment manager. What is this?
Are there fear of people coming over to the house
something? Part of this, I wanted to pay testament to a time that is disappearing. As I've been on tour, I have found, to me, at my age, I was a Vietnam age person, that people seem to be becoming more virtual. I just did a Fusion City show on art and madness, which I thought would be wonderful. And in point of fact, during the Q&A, I was told by very young people in their 20s, that they found these notions totally obsolete. That when I went through Jackson Pollock and Rothko and Gorky, I would just some painters, not to mention every writer worth her or his
Antonin Artaud.
In the 20th century, right. Sylvia Plath, right. Anne Sexton, Edna St. Vincent Millay. It's just been a story of alcoholism, suicide, madness, often simultaneously or sequentially. Lowell, just start thinking about Berryman drank himself to death, Kerouac drank himself to death, that this is the story of art in the 20th century. And to have young people say that they find that notion that you would invest that much of yourself into your art, that you would be that vulnerable and fragile, is outside of their experience. It's outside of their desire. Because they are so much children of corporate, global, village, whatever they call themselves.
It's the ironic distance also. It's like, you read somebody like Chuck Palahniuk, where, I mean, it's very intense, but there's always that couple of steps back from everything.
It's a different kind of art being made for a different purpose, and I can no longer draw a line between pop culture and literature in what is being given to us. And this is the first time in over 30 years that I would say the line is now gone.
Well, I mean, that's sort of what we were trying to do in the 60s, was to erase that line.
But we didn't anticipate that the global village would be filled with idiots.
The global village idiots. On that note, let's stop for a few minutes and listen to some music. Kate Braverman reading to some music. I'm not sure which which song we're going to hear, but we'll be back in a few minutes.
Are you serious?
It rained the rain of curses and world's end. Puddles erupted in the plaza outside the cathedral in Palma in an unnaturally windy October, 2 months before you left me at Christmas in Los Angeles. My hands frozen on tinsel, breathless and stunned, gasping for air. I was one entire year drunk with grief. May you have a nest of squally infants, stupid women, plants that die, illness, and the endless redress of sunset. Once I loved you softly, lazy as a wife hanging sheets in noon sun, accepting the parallel lines of our life, that impossible balancing act. May your autumn be indecently calloused, prolonged and broken. May winter strike without warning, a series of sponge-thin afternoons withering and spilling their guts on your lawn. May you be empty and cut and know the moon is a monster and night poisonous, black as a sea of rats. May you sleep with fevers and splintered dream and sense me incandescent with the grandeur of unspeakable malice I will you in this life and all others.
Back with Kate Braverman. Before I was commenting on how much I like the way your book just seems to like move through so many different personalities, and yet somehow it all seems to cohere. And talk a little bit about how you can, you know, take all these.
I have always encouraged my students in whatever they're writing to just write in fragments as much as of a piece that you can see, put it away. Write another fragment. Come back and look at what the fragments have done over a year or 18 months and see what doesn't naturally seem to cohere or what you can sew, glue, stitch, or razzle dazzle into place. And I had these loose pieces, roughly, sort of, about Los Angeles. And when I felt they needed a transition, I threw in poems and just titled it Leaving by Magic, the stand-up comedy I've been writing, the Marilyn Monroe interview in here, along with some real essays that after I sold the book or won the Grey Wolf Prize, I went back and put in all the subversive aspects that I had left out originally when they were written for a corporate purpose.
You had an advantage in a sense because you're writing a memoir rather than a novel. So, I mean, you know what the storyline is.
It's all the same.
But I mean,
whether you call it a memoir, whether you call it a novel, I think that Hunter Thompson, Tom Wolfe, and Joan Didion were talking now. You know, Orthodox theory says that no writing came out of the 60s, as if the experiment with experience was so de facto sorted, especially to people on EST, that no art could have come out of it.
Right.
But by my examination of Bill Volman and going back further, I have seen that the 70s were a fire zone of great writing, most of it centered here in California.
You just mentioned William Volman. Who else would you pick out as...
I just love Bill's work, and I love Europe Central. I love his work in general, and that he won the National Book Award and the Bay Area Book Award, I think says something about San Francisco being not only the most literate city in America, but also becoming recognized nationally, and that this is something we should all share, and it's a great moment.
Sounds like they're coming to pick up Bill.
Are they reading my mind? Yeah. Okay, so now that I observe Los Angeles from my apple orchard in the Allegheny Mountains, the cause and effect are obvious. As the mythic allure of Los Angeles dissipates, as technology makes it viable to live in Maui or Telluride or even here in a village between Pittsburgh and Toronto, it's like the gigantic set is being struck. They've packed away the costumes, crated the props, bits of stage design. Computer graphics have made three-dimensional manifestations unnecessary. L.A. has no artifacts, only debris. And I know the Los Angeles that's been left behind. It's the L.A. that was always there, a city of the disadvantaged, ignored, and dismissed, the invisible legions inhabiting
anonymous.
Outskirts and back streets enameled by sun while the city of dream came and is now departing. Now it's the land of the children of the bit players, and there's nothing virtual about them. They are real, and they are angry. They never liked their bad acid trip, cheap motel-like apartments emblazoned with insults in six languages. Through ripped mesh, stepfathers and boyfriends verbally abuse the girls. Syllables of degradation ricochet in sand and salt breeze like hand grenades that are internalized. The skies look like a battlefield. You can mutilate yourself standing on a patio at sunset. And now many of their progeny are drugged and armed. In a town that makes even supermodels want to commit suicide, they've breathed all the cactus splinters and adobe dust they can. They're over the measurable legal limit. They're the progeny of demolished for shopping malls, tract houses that came for another chance and didn't get it. They longed for a moment in the sun and got radiation burns and melanoma instead. These are the children of single women spending weekends with blinds closed to shut out alleys of scorched oleander. On the boulevards below, any vehicle can contain AK-47s. They're the potential infrastructure, the contingency plan locked in storage generations beyond divorce.
And you're writing this from a small town in the Allegheny Mountains.
Your point of view is from having gone
to the Allegheny Mountains in upstate New York. What town
what
were you in?
What you call it upstate New York is really to elevate it in significance. It was remote, rural, western New York.
Right.
One wrong
well,
turn.
Well, I grew up in Binghamton, New York. So,
okay. Alan grew up 40 miles from Binghamton. Do you know Norwich?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, that's where he's from.
Okay. And one of the things that struck me when you get to this area, you're pretty kind to the people there. You don't express a lot of your sort of typical urban boho alienation towards the people, except in a little passage towards the end where you expect to be searched by Homeland Security
on the way out of town. I wrote the epiphany for this book, which was called Chasing the Trains, and it's what happened after we found out that our house was for sale, that it had sold, which we found out in Tahiti, and that we had 8 days to get from Bora Bora. The house was only sold if we could get out in 8 days, and we had to get from Bora Bora, and we thought there was nothing left, that all the important things were in San Francisco, and I would have liked to put in what we had to carry across the country in the summer of 2004, also known as the presidential summer, leaving a red area to drive through those red states with Semitic features, even with the sunglasses and baseball hats and the UC Berkeley and Hillary Clinton for Senate stickers on the car, and all that we had stashed in that farmhouse that we'd forgotten about, the things that you say, well, they're not really there, and then you forget what's under the nail boards, you forget what's in the safety deposit boxes, and so we had a considerable amount of contraband that we had to carry across the country by ourselves during that crude, vicious spectacle, also known as the 2004 presidential campaign. And Grey Wolf would not allow me to publish that aspect.
Oh. Jeez, that's kind of strange.
Yeah.
Now, what did they express a particular motivation for that?
They were utterly dismayed. Is the beginning of the email I received from them. Yes, and it was like I suddenly got to come out of the shadows of what is really a very abstract book, and that I think conventionalizes and sanitizes me. And in this ending, I got to come out of that, but not to have it published. So
I always find it odd that the particular things that set one publishing company or TV or whatever.
What
so one media,
to draw that
one
line?
Media. Yeah, what causes people to draw that line? I had the
it's
experience.
That the corporate line is getting tighter and tighter.
But
and
Grey Wolf, I mean, that's not even corporate. This experience, like I had to do a top 10 list for Art Form of my 10 favorite things of the year, and I decided my favorite thing of the year was this new nasally active form of DMT that a chemist had made. So I listed that as number one. They made me change it to number two because high school kids read the...
But it was okay at two.
It was okay at number two.
Yeah, because high school kids won't pay attention to number two.
They don't read past one.
Only go for number one.
Oh, man.
Do you have any more?
Do I have any more? No.
Okay. Just checking the prudent question at the table.
The important questions. Yes, get asked.
I'm waiting for peyote eye drops myself.
Do you know something that really strikes me about San Francisco is, of course, we live in a theocracy now, which the country is becoming increasingly Christian right-wing, which we know from having lived in the Allegheny Mountains, which may not have hit San Francisco yet, but we really live. They called the border where we lived for 6 years Pentucky. It was 15 minutes from Pennsylvania, and we're talking about a seventh-generation underclass, people who have not worked since the railroads, the dairy farms, the
That's
oil
incredible
wells.
Incredible descriptions in there of,
yes.
of all that, yeah.
And that the level of poverty, when I went to our neighboring town, I had never seen anything like it, and I thought I would really see corpses on the street as I walked. It was like documentary footage of a Kentucky mine strike with footage I've seen of like a Herzegovina where the bodies
are. The Appalachians.
Mm-hmm. And it was a very significant experience in terms of understanding what geography does to you emotionally and psychologically when you are isolated, when getting to the next town 12 miles away is impossible, as you might know from Binghamton. We were the other side of Binghamton another hour and a half, and that most people had never been to New York City and express no desire to do so. No, there is no public transportation. So much of what we take for granted here in San Francisco. But I would like to say that I have noticed that I am a certified California medicinal pot smoker, and to have my new neighbors tell me that this is unacceptable and that they don't want to smell it or see it, I find rather amazing that this is the new climate in San Francisco. And I've noticed when I go to pass a joint around a room that I am often the only one smoking, although drinking seems to be going very well. Every time we have a party, we can't believe what people have drunk. And I am, you know, we buy, you know, just double what we think it could possibly be and go through it. And I find this climate that consciousness, exploration, the fundamental political and aesthetic basis of the 60s is now considered not only de classe socially, but that it has the political ramifications that it does, I find to be of great concern.
Yeah, obviously, it's very, very sad. I want you to triangulate a little bit before we take off. And now that you're in San Francisco, you're talking about Los Angeles and made comparisons between Los Angeles and this little town in upstate New York. And where does San Francisco in general fit into?
San Francisco is the Nepal of the United States. It is the magic kingdom.
We interviewed a Maoist on our show a few weeks ago.
Oh, one of the people in Nepal, one of those Maoists from Nepal. Okay, we ran into them too. And when we were there in Nepal, there is something about San Francisco that I think needs to be saved. And part of it is that we are the land of Hunter Thompson. We are the land when Robert Stone was great. He was doing his work as a Stanford Stegner writer. When Tom McGuane was doing his early great work, it was as a Stanford Stegner writer. When Joan Didion was viable and functional in 1970. But you see, once you have brand name recognition in literature now, you get to continue publishing any dreck you want indefinitely. And people can't discriminate.
Or you would like to know. So if you could hip him to that. The brand name recognition.
I want to get to that point.
Yeah. I think once you're in with the corporation to a certain degree.
I mean, Thompson's
degree,
output got to be pretty sad as well, actually.
True.
I was not, Hunter Thompson had nothing to say to me after Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail, but that changed the entire concept of objectivity for writers. He changed the face of writing, as did Robert Stone and Tom McGuane, all 70s writers, which is one reason I'm very proud that Lithium for Medea is a 1979 book and part of what I think is the most exciting decade. And if you notice, corporate America is really erasing that decade as if it never existed. you know, Hunter Thompson will be called infantile, just like Sylvia Plath, and his work will be off the main track very soon. When I talk to writing students, they've never even heard of Bob Stone. Hmm. Never read any of early Tom McGuane. Joan Didion is an unknown name to them, except for this piece of Drek she just won the National Book Award for.
But who do they know? Who do they read?
Well, it's very frightening to me how little real reading is being done by the younger writers. And they're not even writing for the sense of life and death that I have always written for, and redemption and revelation. They're writing to get into another format entirely. Mm. They're using the book as a way to get a television program or something in another format, basically. And I think that to take the innocent page and inflict your HBO-sized vision on it should be a felony.
Mm. On that note, I think perhaps we will... We'll leave this program behind. Thanks for actually, we sort of wanted to get more into the L.A. versus San Francisco thing, but I think we're running long. So thanks a lot for
it's
coming
been a
in.
Pleasure. I can come back. I live here.
All right, come back. Thanks.
Thank you.
Love is the only weapon.
Are you serious?